Hi, I'm David Lazarus, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 7th, 2014. This show is about how to get not only more money out of the choices you make in life, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, first there was Target, then Neiman Marcus, then White Lodging, which runs some major hotel franchises. Consumer data breaches at these companies left millions of us vulnerable to identity theft. So with our cards at risk, is the safe bet to switch to cash? Some say yes. Rob Weil says no. He's an energy and economics reporter for Business Insider, and he recently wrote a piece called Why Cash is Bad. Thanks for joining us, Rob.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. So cash is bad? I thought it was the safe alternative.
It might be for certain people, but we pinpointed 13 problems with it from the macro level to day-to-day use, so it's not without some problems itself.
Take me to the macro level. What's the big problem with being cash only?
Big problem is that it costs the U.S. economy $200 billion a year in various forms of lost revenue when people use cash. The biggest one is actually tax evasion. When you store stuff in cash, when you have your savings in cash, the government is not really able to tax that, or people don't account for that in their IRS filings. And that actually accounts for about half of that $200 billion.
Okay, so we're all a bunch of tax evading scofflaws. But moving past that, what are cash's problems?
Well, at the next level below, retailers have a major problem with theft. It's people taking stuff out of the till, basically. And the cost of hiring security guards to protect either from robberies or to watch over the employees of the stores themselves amounts to about 0.5% of annual gross revenues, which is, you know, a pretty large sum for a major retailer.
All right. So we're all a bunch of thieving, tax evading scofflaws. But aside from that, what's cash's problem?
Well, the final one, which everyone can relate to in their day-to-day lives, is going back and forth from the ATM costs us 5.6 hours a year, going back and forth visiting the ATM. So when you add that all up, you equate that to the mean hourly wage in the U.S., that gets to about $46 million in lost productivity.
So that's all time that I could have spent productively at my desk watching cat videos.
Exactly. In addition, there are folks for whom who receive their paychecks in cash, you know, the formal term for them is unbanked. They actually pay 3.66% more in fees just from the transactions that they have to do. So it also penalizes people when they forced to use cash.
But Rob, there's going to be a lot of people listening out now who say plastic comes with fees. It means I'm dealing with these big companies that might not necessarily have my back. My various accounts can get hacked. There can be fraud. There can be identity theft. And with cash, I'm facing none of those problems. So convince me.
Right. So obviously there's been a lot of noise about, you know, these major hacks at these major retailers. But the fact of the matter is, the odds that your individual account is going to get hacked remain relatively low. And what people say is, you know, as long as you're smart about it, as long as you keep a regular eye on, you know, your bank account online and make sure that there's no suspicious activity. If you're truly paranoid, you can sign up for some kind of special protections that some banks offer who let you know right away if there's, you know, smell suspicious activity.
So, Rob, do you even carry cash? Maybe some change for the meter?
The only reason why I still go to the ATM occasionally is in New York, you know, we have these delis that are open all night. They sort of frown upon credit cards. Some don't even take them. So I'm sort of forced to, for munching habits, use cash occasionally. But whenever I can, you know, I try to keep it to plastic. Plus, for customers, too, you can't shop on Amazon with cash. And a lot of retail stores are going down these days. That severely limits your options if you've only limited yourself to greenbacks.
The article is called Why Cash is Bad. Rob Weil is a reporter with Business Insider. Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David. Pleasure.
We've been hearing from you all this week, and for every cash hater, there's a cash lover. Here's one of them. If you try and pay with plastic at a certain Southern California store, you'll get this at the register.
Thank you so much for shopping today. How would you like to pay? A card? Did you know there was a pimp in your wallet?
What do you mean?
I mean, there's a pimp in all our wallets, dear. You see this card? Did you know that in your account you're only making 0.25% interest in earning on the money you have in this account we're about to hit?
What? Did you just say there's a pimp in your wallet? We sent Marketplace Money producer Candace Manriquez to find out what's behind this small business owner's disdain for credit.
Welcome to Shades of Africa, Long Beach. My name is Renee Quarles. most of the corporations established are not going to tell its paying customer. I can only make a quarter of a penny in keeping my money, and a man I can't see makes 2.79 to 3.29%? Who are you? And how did you get into my wallet? Those are pimps. Those are entities. I call the man. I grew up hearing the man. And I learned to always identify where the man at, because he's trying to get paid. Can I say what I need to say? Pimps, hoes, and hustlers were my educators. My mother trusted me with them. We were raised by them. And my purpose is to help every one of us understand our part in the oil and the greasing of somebody else's wheel. And it doesn't seem to have a race factor in it. It doesn't matter whether you're black, brown, green, or blue. It is all about taking all monies, and that's where they're at.
Hey, Darren, how are you?
Hey, sister.
How are you?
My name is Darren Turner.
My name is Janae Tucker. I'm at Shades of Africa in Long Beach. Yeah, we always get lectured.
I don't call it a lesson.
Well, yeah, that too, but we never listen because we always pay with the debit card. It's always there. You guys gonna pay with that debit card again?
I'm happy that my customers see it not as a lecture, but more of a lesson. I'm going to slide this for you today, but I hope you remember to tell someone, okay? Tell your family and friends that we'd rather pull our money from the bank. Take your power back.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. So we just heard from a woman whose preferred way of strengthening her consumer power is spending cash, and only cash. The more cash you have, the better you're able to flex your buying power. So think for a second about this number. $1.1 trillion. If we were talking about countries there, we'd be talking about the 16th biggest economy in the world. But we're not talking about a country. We're talking about the combined buying power of African Americans. Noel King of Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk is reporting on what black buying power means to the economy. She joins us now. Hi, Noel.
Hi there.
We're also joined by Jared Ball. He's an associate professor in the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. Welcome, Jared.
It's a pleasure.
So, Noel, start me off by telling me about buying power. What are we talking about here?
Everything after taxes that you have to spend on anything you're going to buy over the course of a year. So whether it's food, clothing, electronics, it doesn't include your savings from past years and it doesn't include credit.
How do we know about this 1.1 trillion number?
Well, the 1.1 trillion is an estimate. What these various economic centers that have done reports on black buying power have done is they've looked at regional economic data and they've looked at census numbers. And they've said by the year 2015, by next year, they expect that African American buying power as a whole is going to hit $1.1 trillion.
Well, how does this change things? Why is this important?
You know, it's really interesting. The Nielsen Company did a report in 2013 on African American buying power, looking at what blacks buy and why they buy it. And I spoke to a woman, Cheryl Pearson McNeil, who's a vice president at Nielsen. And she says, look, there are dollars in black America. There are 1.1 trillion of them. And yet companies aren't spending much money. They're spending about 3% of $75 billion advertising dollars targeting specifically the black community. And she says, if you ignore this demographic, you really do it at your own peril.
The black population is young, hip, and highly influential. We are growing 64% faster than the general market. And you add all of that up to the $1 trillion a year of buying power, and I say, wow, what a great opportunity to be driving this economic 16-wheeler that blacks have.
So, Jared, I see this $1.1 trillion number. I hear the good news side of this. Is it nothing but a happy story here?
From my point of view, no, not at all. It's quite a sad story, in part because this phrase, buying power, is used as sort of a glossy euphemism for black poverty being the fault of black spending habits, as opposed to the result of a predetermined need in our economic model. So a lot of people pick up this phrase and hear these large numbers, and they assume that black people are stronger economically than black America actually is. This issue of buying power is meant to strengthen the ability of corporations to take what little money there is in Black America out of Black America into these corporations. This does not speak to actual economic or certainly political strength in Black America.
All right. But I remember back in the Civil Rights Movement when we saw the bus boycott and we saw Black buying power being exercised as an economic and political force. You're saying we're not seeing that anymore?
What is left out of that conversation or that history is how Dr. King and others would eventually raise the question, well, now that these lunch counters are desegregated, the sandwich that was a dollar yesterday costs $3. The struggles around the boycott in the early stages of the civil rights movement did not really fundamentally address the deepening and worsening economic inequality and ultimately powerlessness of Black Americans. So this is why he and others would eventually lead, evolve their struggle to be more focused on capitalism as an economic model, structural inequality, and so on. What is being described as buying power or consumer power and the ability maybe to destabilize a local bus company or a lunch counter does not actually have anything to do with the ability to sustain or develop a community, improve its economy, to guarantee jobs, to guarantee a parity in wealth.
Well, Noel, is it fair to draw this distinction? Do we see consumers by different ethnicities, different races, different genders, or is a consumer just a consumer?
In a lot of cases, a consumer is just a consumer, but different groups spend more on different things. And the argument is, if you want to market to those groups, then you should know what particular group buys your stuff. Blacks tend to spend more on electronics, utilities, groceries, footwear. They spend a lot less on new cars, alcohol, entertainment, healthcare, and pensions.
Noel King is at Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk. Jared Ball is an associate professor in the School of Global Journalism and Communications at Morgan State University. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Join the conversation on African American wealth at marketplacemoney.org and listen for more of Noel's coverage of Black buying power next week on Marketplace. Coming up later in the show, advertisers, keep it real.
It's about time that Madison Avenue and advertisers are really embracing the reality of what America is today.
But first, we answer your money questions next on Marketplace Money from APM. Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, filling in for Carmen Wong Ulrich. And that's my favorite part of the show, when we get to bring you in and answer your questions. We've got a whole bunch of callers chomping at the bit with some, looks like, pretty tough questions today. Our first one is John in Menominee, Wisconsin. Hiya, John.
Hi.
Okay, Madison I've been to. Menominee, not so much. If you were a member of the Chamber of Commerce, what would you tell me about your fair city?
It's a small town. It's about 60 miles east of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Twin Cities area.
Okay, so let's get into your financial situation.
Well, my main question is, when do I want to start collecting Social Security? I'm kind of a financial Luddite, so you'll have to take it easy on me, but I've been asking around, and I have all kinds of different answers to my questions.
How old are you now?
Right now, I'm 61.
And when do you want to call it quits when it comes to work?
That's a good question. I think that I would like to slow way down when I'm 62 anyhow.
Okay, so you're looking at the finish line gradually coming into sight more sooner than later, and you're wondering about the checks. Let me ask you this. If I could tell you that you could get 8% a year on some investment, would you think that was a good return?
Yeah,
I think most of us would. Well, here's the deal. You can start collecting Social Security when you're 62 and all the way up to when you're 70 or thereafter. Now, every year that you wait, John, the amount of money you can receive per month from Uncle Sam goes up by 8%. So that's a pretty big chunk of change.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're looking at now is if you were to actually start collecting Social Security next year when you're 62, you'll be getting about 75% of your total potential nest egg from Social Security. Now, you wait a little bit. If you get all the way up to 66, then you're going to get 100%. But that's not it, because Uncle Sam gets a little generous after that. If you wait till you're 70, you'll get 132% of your total amount. Thus, the longer you wait, the more you get, and that amount goes up by 8% a year. So you've got a very powerful incentive to put off collecting those checks for as long as you possibly can. How does that affect your thinking?
Somewhat affects it. There's a couple of other things that I could throw into the mix, one of which is I have a money market fund and I have a couple of IRAs. And one suggestion was to take one of the IRAs and turn it into an annuity and collect that.
That's interesting stuff. A lot of people think about that. First of all, big props to you, John, because you kind of have your ducks in a row. You got your IRA. You're thinking about the sunset years. So, first of all, props to that. Now, as for the annuity, this is a tricky business. The jury is still out on whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, because it's not a one-size-fits-all deal. There's various forms of annuities out there. The most common is what's known as the immediate annuity, which is you're going to give a chunk of change to some insurance company, and in turn, they're going to give you a set amount per month. And is that what you're looking at?
That's kind of what I was looking at, yeah.
Now, the trick to this is you come out way ahead if you live a long time.
Right.
Do you have any health issues?
No.
Okay. So in that sense then, because, you know, you're playing beat the clock, then the annuity is something that you do want to talk about. The idea of getting a regular payment, as you would with a pension, for example, which so few of us have these days, well, all right, that's attractive. Let's talk about what's unattractive about an annuity. First of all, you're going to be tying up a big amount of money in this investment that you're going to make with the insurance company. And a lot of experts are going to say, you know what? Down the road, as you get older, your biggest concern is going to be healthcare. You could face any number of problems that are going to come up. You have no idea how much they're going to cost. Well, if you tie up a lot of money in an annuity, that's money that is not liquid, that cannot be applied to healthcare, and that can kind of leave you in the lurch. Second thing to think about is the fees. Annuities aren't free. It's kind of like a mutual fund. There's going to be a management fee to the annuity, and this can run as high as 2.5% in some cases, which is more than you're ever going to see with a mutual fund. Those fees are not your friend. They are going to eat away at your money, and that's a thing as well. So what you're weighing right now is the attractiveness of that monthly payment for the rest of your life if you buy the correct annuity. Good thing. And you're weighing that versus the lack of liquidity at a time when you're going to want to be a little liquid, especially for healthcare. And then, in any case, if you do take the annuity plunge, you're going to want to look around for something that's not going to hit you with fees.
I didn't realize there was some annuities had fees and some didn't.
What I do want to emphasize, though, is don't put all your eggs in one basket. And so if you feel that you're not covered sufficiently with liquid cash for potential crises, mostly healthcare crises, think twice before you go down the annuity road.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, good advice.
All right, John. So you think about that. Let us know what you decide, and also email me with a list of things that I want to go see in Menominee, okay?
All right, will do.
All right, good luck.
Thank you very much.
My compliments to John for asking such a good question. I'm going to take a break right here, and we'll be right back in just a moment with more of your calls. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times. Taking your calls right now, as I say, my favorite part of the show, no question about it. Our next caller is Jason calling from Austin, Texas. Hiya, Jason.
Hi, how are you?
I'm real good. Austin, totally cool place these days. Who would have guessed that cowboy land would turn into this hipster paradise?
I know, it's a crazy turn.
What do you do?
Technically, I am a user experience designer.
You're a what?
Well, that's the catchphrase title, a user experience designer. I do computer programming and industrial design.
So the user experience designer, are you the guy who is making the interface? Are you the guy who's designing the Coke bottle?
Well, yeah, I started out in more in graphics, and I moved into the user interface design and programming, and now I still program. And if people can use it, you've done your job.
They pay you for this?
I know. It's pretty amazing. In fact, I'm in my PJs right now because I'm working from home.
All right, let's talk about your financial situation. What's coming up on the horizon?
I'm planning to get married, and, you know, the plan is to get married and buy a house this year. And I had heard that for a two-income household, you can take a big hit when you're married. And so I just was wondering if there's a way to get married without the whole IRS part of it, or if that's even a concern that I should be worried about, and if that's going to also affect buying a home. And my girlfriend and prospective wife is, she has an office job, and so she's on a great health insurance plan. Me as a freelancer, I'd really like to get on her plan, but we need to be married or maybe not. I'm not sure of the specifics.
So have you always been such a hopeless romantic, Jason? You're worried about, you know, your taxes and things, and I'm hearing wedding bells, and I'm, you know, people are saying mazel tov, and you're sitting here thinking, I don't know, marriage penalty. All right, let's talk. You're looking at the marriage penalty, and this isn't a new thing out there. When couples tie their financial fortunes together, there are tax repercussions. It's usually most dramatic for people when they are of similar incomes, because those two incomes, when wedded together, can push you up into a higher tax bracket. And that's not a happy thing. And there you are filing jointly at a higher tax level, and you're thinking, well, why doesn't Uncle Sam like love? And I'm guessing that's what you're looking at.
Yeah, exactly.
And the answer to that is Uncle Sam likes love just fine. He just hasn't quite figured out how to work out the whole tax thing. But there have been attempts at it. And that's why when you look at the financial horizon, you're going to see some things that are going to make you say, ouch. And you're going to see some things that will make you say, ooh. For example, your capital gains deduction when you sell a home as a married couple, it's double. You can deduct $500,000 rather than $250,000. So there are things, there are trade-offs out there for getting married. So that's the first thing, is it's not all doom and gloom. You are going to get some financial benefits as well.
Okay.
All right, that's one thing. Another thing to keep in mind, if you guys want to file separately, you can do that, but you're not going to get the same favorable treatments you would have gotten had you been single. So it might not make the best sense. You're probably looking at filing jointly no matter what. Here's my bottom line advice. First of all, talk to an accountant. You know, see what tricks and things you might be able to bring into play here. But the bottom line, here you are. You've got this beautiful woman in your life. You're in love. You're thinking about getting married and bringing yourselves together and spending the rest of your lives together. And this is like birds are chirping and rainbows are forming and unicorns are prancing. Don't worry about tax problems. Seriously.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's good to be aware of your finances, but it's better to embrace what is about to happen to you. All of these very material concerns that should not be a concern at this point. They should be on your radar screen. They should be something you're thinking about, but they should be something you're thinking about as a byproduct to the much more important thing, which is, I'm getting married.
Well, I thought she's going to love that answer because I'm not sure she was too excited about all of my financial sort of misgivings.
Yeah, she's going to probably smack you upside the head, Jason, and say, dude, read some poetry. You're thinking about the wrong things. And I'm with her. But then you go back to your significant other and you say, okay, good. I'm with the program now. But let's go to the accountant together. And let's talk about the marriage penalty with the accountant together. Let's talk about what we're seeing down the road in terms of child credits and capital gains and all those other things, and balance the pros and the cons. It's a conversation that you want to have together because, and I can't emphasize this enough, this is a partnership. It is a shared adventure when you bring your finances together. You tell your sweetie, look, the tax thing, it's not so important to me.
All right. Well, that's great advice. I'm on board.
I knew you would be. Jason, thank you so much for calling. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, looks like we got time for one more question. Let's check in with Amanda calling from Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, David.
So how about them Broncos?
Oh, don't get me started. Heartbreaking.
How was the mood in your household on that day?
It was pretty depressing, I have to say.
So, Amanda, tell me a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a park ranger here in Boulder, Colorado, and my husband is too. We have a bit of a unique situation. So we both work for a local government. We have two small boys, 4.5 and 1.5. And my question is really about priority of savings. We have a really lucky situation that we have pretty stable jobs with great benefits. So we have really great retirement plans in which we both contribute. We also both have a 401k plan through those. We set up 529 plans for our sons, and we are just lately starting our emergency fund, starting to build that. And about every year, we can pretty much count on getting either a cost of living raise or usually a merit bonus increase to our wages. So our question is kind of how we can prioritize the extra money as it comes into our budget, where we should be prioritizing our savings.
Okay, here's me looking incredibly envious as you tell me about living in one of the most beautiful places in the world and you spend your days outdoors walking around in the woods. Do I have that right?
Mostly.
Oh,
you know,
goodness.
With any job, there's a downside, but I am not going to complain. I have a wonderful job and I love it.
Okay, you are in such a good position because here you are telling me that you're planning for your retirement, you're planning for your kids' college education, you're planning on an emergency fund, for goodness sakes, and now you're telling me you got some extra money coming in and you're not sure what to do with it. Yeah?
I guess that sounds pretty good now that you say it that way, yeah.
And then in your spare time, you're walking around in the woods and getting paid for it. So everyone listening is going, Amanda, you rock. So let's get that out of the way. So you got some extra money coming in, and your key thing here is going to be, now tell me how old your kids are.
4.5 and 1.5.
You got some window ahead of you. My kid
yeah.
is 12, and I've got a 529 plan for him. And when the recession rolled around, we took a 30% hit on that sucker.
Ooh.
And my window is now a lot smaller
uh-huh.
to try to make up for that. You're smart to be thinking about these things. Now,
okay.
the experts are going to tell you, always plan for your retirement first.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most important thing. It's kind of like you're on the airplane and you start crashing and the air masks pop down and they always tell you put the air mask on yourself first, then you put it on your kid.
Right.
All right. Same idea here financially.
Okay.
So don't lose sight of your 401k.
Okay.
I mean, that's key because if you don't do it, no one else will. I say that
right.
all the time. But that said, I'm going to probably advise you to maybe be a little more aggressive on the 529 than other experts might say. And that's only because I've been bitten
right.
by this. And having been bitten and watching the clock ticking on that and not wanting to leave my kids in the lurch, I find that I take whatever liquid cash I might have and I might spread it a little more evenly than I used to.
Okay.
Just something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
I mean, you still have a big window ahead of you. But here's the other thing that I want you and your husband to think about when you're not thinking about bears chasing you down the trail. And that is look into financial aid options for education. There's a lot of them out there. And as tuition costs keep rising, many universities, public and private, are trying to come up with new vehicles, new products that they can offer to prospective students to help make this process less painful on the money front.
Okay.
And so there are things happening out there. Things are changing as the tuition costs go up. You want to explore that, regardless of your income level. Even high-income people want to explore this because there are possibilities out there. So it doesn't mean that if your kid's going to college, you're bankrupt. End of story.
Yeah.
So make sure you look at this. And as you get closer, like let's say once your kids start driving and you're freaking out about that, you minimize the freak out by sitting down and looking online at some of the financial aid options that are going to be available and see what it's going to be. Now, there's going to be paperwork involved. There's going to be a lot of stepping up and here's my tax returns. Here's my employment information. Be ready for that.
Okay.
Meanwhile, don't lose sight of the retirement planning. What kind of pension do you get as a ranger?
We both are in what's called the PARA program, Colorado PARA. So we both get a pension, and my husband's, it's 100% pension. And, you know, our employer matches what we put in, or they do put in more than what we put in, actually. And I have that in addition to we also pay into Social Security. So we're really pretty set up pretty well. His employer actually used to even match on his 401k in addition, but they've stopped doing that recently. So we're pretty well set up on the retirement front, except that we have not maxed out our 401ks just because so much of our paycheck is taken away into those pensions that we just need more cash on hand with two small boys than we can actually max out our 401ks. So, you know, we plan on putting more and more into that, but we just haven't been able to max it out yet.
All right, let me tell you what I want you to do, Amanda, and that is email me an application to be a park ranger.
We have seasonal positions opening.
Sweet. That's what I'm thinking about. And again, my props to you because you are doing everything right. So well done.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's really, really helpful.
Great pleasure. Amanda, thanks for calling.
All right, thanks.
Last week in our segment exploring President Obama's new retirement proposals, we misstated the age a person must reach to avoid penalties for withdrawing money from a private sector IRA. The correct age is 59 and a half. Mandatory withdrawals begin at age 70 and a half. Now we know. Just ahead, we tackle one of those awkward money moments.
So having less money than your friends can become very awkward or challenging if you let it. And the key is not letting it.
Keeping your friendship strong and your wallet stronger. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus, in for Carmen Wong Ulrich. So a friend says, hey, let's go to that cool new restaurant. What you hear is, let's go to that new ultra-expensive cool new restaurant. You want to go, but you look at your bank account and you know you shouldn't. We've all been there, having to make hard decisions when our friends have more money than we do. Fortunately, we have a guide.
My name is Samantha Scharf, and I'm a reporter with Forbes. I cover personal finance for young people. And I live in New York City. I'm really drawn to stories about the way we interact with money and the way it impacts our daily lives, the way we feel about things. And this is something that everyone deals with. So having less money than your friends can become very awkward or challenging if you let it. And the key is not letting it. One of my favorite points that a manners expert I spoke to had was that the best etiquette is living within your means. This was a woman named Jody Smith, and her feeling is that etiquette is anything that impacts your interaction with other people. So I think the first step is keeping that in mind, that you're not going to be able to have a natural and fun interaction with your friends if you're trying to outspend yourself. On a more practical level, she also talks about something called preemptive etiquette. And that's the idea of staying ahead of it. Be the friend in the know. Be the person who knows about the great pizza place where you can get a $2 slice. If you love art, be the person who knows the nights the museum is open late and free. If you stay ahead of it and you're able to recommend these more frugal activities, you can control what you're spending. And everyone likes to save money. And deals like that can, even if you don't need them, can be novel and fun. Sometimes you're going to have to say no. It is not fun, but people have to say no for all sorts of different reasons. Your saying no isn't necessarily going to be a red flag that you don't have money if it's something that you want to keep personal. But it's also about knowing the friends you can talk about it with. So if it's someone you're close to and they're recommending a dinner that you simply can't fathom affording, tell them. You should never go into debt in order to have a fun night out. Know how much money you have. By knowing where it's going, you can control it, and you can look at a spending opportunity and know whether you have that money's there.
Be sure to check out Samantha's article in Forbes. It's called A Tale of Two Incomes. You may have seen the Rocky-themed commercial, Yo, Adrian, for a loan company called Rise. What's that? They offer short-term, high-interest loans for what they call a different kind of emergency loan. Well, the campaign says their loans can help you write your comeback story. They're one of several companies expanding their profile into the short-term loan space and attempting to distinguish themselves from infamous payday loans, which have kind of gotten a black eye over the years. Well, here to tell us what they are, what they do, and what to look out for is Alex Horowitz. He studies the good and the bad of these loans for the Pew Charitable Trusts. Alex, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
I'm writing about these Rise guys in my column in this coming week, which people can find at latimes.com. It's put out by something called Think Finance in Texas. And I talked to the CEO of Think Finance the other day, a guy named Ken Reese, and he explained that this is a new generation of financial products that's different from a payday loan. How is that?
Installment loans are more affordable for consumers because the payments are much lower and take up a smaller share of someone's paycheck. But prices can rise to non-competitive levels, and many of the products in the installment loan market end up having such high prices that their interest rates are similar to payday loans.
Well, and what I'm kind of flummoxed by is here in California, we might see payday loans where the APR tops 400%. Now, this Rise loan is offered with an initial APR of 174%, which is still pretty big. And yet Mr. Reese at Think Finance said, but the thing about this loan that makes it different is over time, as you pay it down, the APR can go down to 36%. To which I'm thinking, well, yeah, but if you're living paycheck to paycheck, 36% is still a pretty hefty chunk of change.
Well, it's worth thinking about affordability as being different than price. Affordability is what percentage of someone's paycheck the loan takes up, while price can rise to non-competitive levels, and that's reflected in the interest rate. So an affordable installment loan will generally take up 5% or less of a borrower's paycheck, but interest rates at some of the levels seen in the installment loan market are not necessary to sustain this market. But what's important is that people essentially can look around and make clean comparisons. One of the big problems with high interest loans is that even though they're advertised as being for a short period of time, people end up in debt for a lot of the year. So really, these are not transparent products.
In fact, when I talked to those fellows behind Rise, they said that it often takes as long as 2 years to pay down one of these loans. When you think that this loan was structured as a 2-week loan, that seems like an awfully long time. So what can somebody do about that? If you have to take out the loan because you're facing a cash crunch, how can you accelerate the process so you can get out from under that debt?
Well, one of the big problems here is that payments are often set higher than what someone can afford. So we end up seeing a lot of refinancing in that space. And in fact, if fees on loans are front-loaded, which sometimes happens in the installment loan market, and when borrowers refinance, they end up paying origination fees over and over again.
It's also worth pointing out that after the fifth Rocky movie, Rocky ends up broke and brain-damaged. Alex Horowitz covers predatory lending and payday loans and others of that ilk for the Pew Charitable Trust. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Advertisers love it when their work generates buzz. That's the whole point, right? Now, if we're talking about commercials, we're more likely to think about those products when we're spending money. But lately, the buzz around some ad campaigns seems to be more about their casting choices rather than what they're selling. For example, Cheerios, Swiffer, and American Apparel. We've noticed a more inclusive approach to attracting consumers, and we bet you have too. Here to tell us more about what's behind this trend is Anne Christine Diaz. She's the creativity editor at Ad Age. Welcome, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of Super Bowl watchers watching the various ads, and one that really jumped out was the Cheerios ad that had the interracial family.
You know how our family has daddy and mommy?
And me.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's about time that Madison Avenue and advertisers are really embracing the reality of what America is today. It's no longer the case that the all-American family is a Ralph Lauren ad. You know, if you look at the changing demographics and the changing population of America, or at least of the major metropolitan cities, families are growing more and more diverse. So I think it's only a smart move for advertisers to embrace that reality, especially with the rise of social media and the rise of the voice of the consumer empowered by social media. Advertisers are having to be more real, get more real, because there are so many people now who could keep them in check about what their messages are.
I'm thinking also about a recent Swiffer ad that featured a disabled man.
When you only have one hand, you're not doing anything as fast as you used to. Which is funny, because I still do it better than her.
You know, I don't think I was meant to sweep.
It's a little frustrating. Look.
I can't help out as much as I used to.
What happens in that ad?
That ad focuses on the Rukavina family. The father in that family has lost one of his arms. So basically, it talks about how the use of the Swiffer has improved their daily lives. You know, he can reach things that he no longer was able to reach because of the loss of his arm. But the way the ad portrays it is very matter of fact. They're having fun. It's like a normal day in the life of a family, just as the Cheerios ad was. Once again, another advertiser is recognizing that American families, they're diverse. They consist of people from different ethnic backgrounds. They consist of people with disabilities.
And you mentioned how social media plays a role in this and that advertisers are hearing the cacophony of voices out there and trying to respond to it. And yet social media can also produce a backlash. I'm thinking about the Coke ad during the Super Bowl where they were singing America the Beautiful in various languages.
So beautiful for spacious skies.
Por tus olas de granos tambar.
And in that case, we saw there was a lot of, well, hateful responses.
For sure. I mean, you could call that a backlash, but maybe that's the sort of backlash that an advertiser like Coca-Cola would appreciate, because it's that sort of backlash that will bring to light, you know, certain kinds of haters. In this case, the racist comments against that ad that was getting a lot of attention, and many of the negative reactions have been pointed towards those who were rejecting the ad.
Well, not to be cynical, but isn't any buzz good buzz if you're on Madison Avenue?
Definitely. And that's part of the thinking behind these advertisers when they do make these decisions to stray from the quote-unquote norm.
Well, there's a lot of clutter out there in the advertising world. Coke isn't known for its shock value, per se, but American Apparel, on the other hand, is known for kind of getting in people's faces. And they recently had an ad in which they had a more advanced woman, let's say, showing the stuff rather than the young teenage-toned body. Are they going for shock value, or are they trying to go for diversity there?
You know, it's interesting. When I first heard about that particular ad, I assumed that it was being exploitative, in a way that I feel like maybe some of American Apparel's previous advertising has been exploitative. But when I actually looked at the ad itself, it was pretty beautiful. It was subtle. She looked beautiful in her old age in American Apparel. It didn't seem dirty or nasty to me. I thought that was an interesting move for American Apparel, actually.
Sort of similar to what Dove did when they started showing, let's say, plus-sized women in their advertising.
Exactly. So Dove has done an amazing job in changing our perceptions of what beauty is, you know, and I think it's impacted other advertisers. For example, American Eagle, its lingerie line Aerie, recently came out with this campaign where they're now using what they call real young women, as opposed to the sorts of models that they had used before. Of course, these women are still totally beautiful, but they're less varnished, and they conform less to that typical ultra-skinny, big-busted ideal that was obvious in their previous advertising.
For an advertiser, you're obviously trying to push products, but is there a bigger benefit, an ancillary benefit to keeping it real?
I think there is. You know, there's so many products out there. So the more goodwill that you foster with consumers, the more you show them that you represent something beyond just the sell, that's going to engender some brand loyalty among people. They're going to turn to the brand that they like, the brand that they would be friends with, basically.
So I don't have to worry so much about why I don't look like an Abercrombie & Fitch model?
No. And if you look at how they're doing, it hasn't really paid off for them lately, I don't think.
Ann Christine Diaz is the creativity editor at Ad Age. Ann, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again. It was fun.
Just like advertisers, we too know the power of social media. So I've invited Marketplace Money's digital guru, Raghu Manavalan, to crawl out from behind his keyboard and join me in the studio today. Let's talk about what's getting traction out there in cyberland, on Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, AOL chat rooms, the whole gamut. Hiya, Raghu.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
So what's going on in Twitterland?
Well, last week we had a story. It was called Why Women Don't Roar at Work. It went over why some women might be held back from promotions or raises and things like that because they don't speak up about their accomplishments.
Wait a minute. This is the age of sharing. You know, this is what the whole social media is about. And you're telling me that people don't want to bang their drum at the office?
Well, it seems like on Twitter and Facebook, they're all about humble bragging. But in the office, no one likes someone that's arrogant or bragging. So that might hold them back from raises.
Hashtag color me surprised.
Yeah, right. But we put up a poll on our website. We asked people, are you comfortable with bringing up your accomplishments to your bosses? About half of the people said, yeah, I do it because I have to. The other half said, you know what? I put my head down, I do my work, and I hope I climb the ladder.
God, that's unlike almost everybody else listening, I'm sure.
I hope so. I mean, no one does like someone that's arrogant and bragging at work, but I'll read some of the responses we got, actually. I toot my horn at work, but not enough. Interesting. I worked in journalism, now public relations. We live on awards competitions. Sarah Fulliman said, never or rarely. I'm probably penalized for not tooting my own horn. So it's not something that people feel comfortable with, but you do want to make sure that people, you don't go unnoticed.
Do you get a sense that even though face-to-face, people might be a little reticent about the whole humble brag thing, but online, anything goes?
Right. I mean, maybe in the future we'll see people do their performance reviews online and take away face-to-face interactions. Maybe that will help people open up about the things that they're getting done. I think also people don't feel comfortable throwing their colleagues under the bus. And if you're saying, I'm doing such a great job, it might come off as saying, the 10 people around me aren't doing a great job.
So I shouldn't be talking about you right now.
Not right now, but maybe once I leave the studio.
Bingo. What else are people buzzing about online?
The last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of upheaval in the stock market. You know, I don't know why people are worried about day-to-day swings in the market. On this show, we consistently tell people, don't worry about the stock market every day. You should be worried about your retirement accounts when you're retiring, which hopefully is 10 or 20 years down the line.
Yeah, but that's a hard sell because in the social media world, everything is about immediacy. Everything is about now, now, now. So when the stock market is getting its knickers in a twist, it's very hard not to get all caught up in the momentum.
That's true. I mean, you can look every 15 minutes, the stock prices are changing, right? But it's important to keep perspective. None of us are retiring tomorrow. And if you are retiring tomorrow, make sure you're diversified. You shouldn't even be completely in stocks anyway.
So is there anything else that people are buzzing about out there?
Well, we are a few days away from Valentine's Day.
Woohoo!
So I will be looking out for your best frugal Valentine's Day gifts. We won't tell your wife that they were frugal. Hopefully they were nice. We'll be looking at best ways to bring up that money conversation. Bring up how much debt do you have before you get married? Do you both want to own a home? Well, I'll be out there. I'll be at Live Money. I'll be on our Facebook page. Send us your questions. I'll be there 24/7. Go into our AOL chat room. I'll be there.
So your Valentine's Day social life totally happening because you're just going to be there online lurking around.
Absolutely. Pretty much.
All right, Raghu, you don't send me flowers, but boy, you send me tweets. I'm grateful. What can
Thank
I
you.
Say?
Thank you.
And as you heard Raghu say, at Live Money, that's how you find us on Twitter. Come see us on Facebook. Come see us on the radio because we're always here for you. Raghu, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And that's it for Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, Carmen Wong Ulrich is back in the captain's seat answering your money questions. Marketplace Money is produced by Dan Semitovich, Candace Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. And Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer, vice president, and grand poobah. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. And thank you so much for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.